From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Jim Hall, the musician many fellow jazz musicians and critics consider the best guitarist in jazz. Also, choreographer Elliot Feld tells us about making classical ballet and modern dance compatible. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead fills us in on the jazz scene in England. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season premiere of POV, Public Television's showcase for independently produced documentaries. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. British police say that the blast that injured two people today at an exclusive London social club was caused by a bomb. The head of Scotland Yard's anti-terrorist squad says the bomb was planted inside the doorway of the Carlton Club, a gathering place for conservative politicians in central London. It's not known how many people were inside the club at the time of the blast. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, a member of the club, was in Dublin, Ireland, attending a summit of European community leaders. In northwest Iran, aftershocks have continued to hamper relief work in the areas devastated by Thursday's earthquake. The authorities say they're still searching for survivors, but have little hope of finding more. Foreign aid has been flooding in, and the first American goodwill mission to Iran in over 10 years had a mixed reception. Mike Theodoulou reports.
Helicopters sprayed disinfectant over stricken areas as the authorities urged people to leave for fear of disease. Others made dangerous flights to mountain villages cut off by fresh landslides, hoping to rescue thousands still buried under rubble. The dead are being buried in mass graves. A top spiritual leader says religious rites can be waived in the circumstances. Foreign aid has been pouring in from around the world, welcome from all but Israel and South Africa. Relief supplies from a private American organization were accepted, but workers accompanying it were politely asked to leave after being in Iran for just 90 minutes. Survivors are said to be surprised and delighted by the American aid, but a hardline paper said the U.S. is being stingy, sending supplies worth only a fraction of what Sylvester Stallone gets for playing Rambo. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
The Supreme Court ruled today that states may bar relatives of a permanently unconscious person from acting on that patient's behalf. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Nancy Cruzan has been in a persistent vegetative state for over 7 years. Her parents wanted to end her life by having the tubes that provide her food and hydration removed. The state of Missouri, however, moved to intervene, saying it had an interest in preserving life no matter what the quality of life. The state Supreme Court agreed. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court took the middle ground, ruling by a 5-4 vote that in Cruzan's case, the parents could not make the decision to withdraw food and water from their daughter because there was not clear and convincing evidence to show she would have made such a decision had she been competent to do so. The court, however, left states free to craft state laws that permit surrogates to make such a decision, and the court for the first time said that food and water may be withdrawn from a comatose person who has previously expressed a clear wish to die in such circumstances. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 12 points to close at 2,845. Declines led advances by a margin of 2-1 in light trading. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court ruled today in favor of two state laws that restrict abortions for minors. In two separate rulings, the court upheld Ohio and Minnesota laws that require parental notification and waiting periods before minors can have abortions. The decision is regarded as further restricting the right to abortion guaranteed by the court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision. About half the states now require some parental involvement in minors' decisions about abortion. In April of last year, a jogger was attacked in New York Central Park, raped repeatedly, struck with a brick and a lead pipe, and left for dead. Today, opening statements were presented in state Supreme Court in Manhattan, where three defendants were accused of attempted murder, rape, and sodomy in the assault. Carol Zimmer reports.
Prosecutor Elizabeth Lederer presented a chilling portrait for the jury of 10 men and 2 women of a scene that unfolded on an April night in Central Park. She told them that after repeatedly raping the jogger and beating her unconscious, the three defendants, Yusef Salon, Antron McRae, and Raymond Santana, left the jogger for dead in a dark and empty woods. Then they continued through the park looking for other victims. But she also told the jury that DNA testing linking the defendants to the victim had been inconclusive. In addition, a semen-stained sock belonging to the jogger did not match any of the defendants. Lederer also mentioned the name of the jogger, who has not been identified publicly. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Zimmer reporting.
The House passed a new bill today to authorize funding for the Amtrak passenger rail system. The bill replaces one vetoed by President Bush because of a provision that would have expanded government oversight of railroad takeovers. The bill authorizes about $700 million a year for Amtrak operations in 1991 and 1992. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jim Hall is the favorite guitarist of many jazz musicians and listeners. Since the 1960s, he's been a regular winner of the Downbeat Critics Poll. New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot describes Hall as having a grace, inventiveness, and lyricism that make him preeminent among contemporary jazz guitarists and put him within touching distance of the two grandmasters, Charlie Christian and Django Reinhardt. Hall started recording in the 1950s. In the early part of his career, he played with groups led by Jimmy Giuffre, Chico Hamilton, Ben Webster, and Sonny Rollins. This Tuesday, the JVC Jazz Festival in New York will present the Jim Hall Invitational. Hall will perform with many of the people he's recorded and performed with over the years, including Jerry Mulligan, Ron Carter, and Bob Brookmeyer. Pat Metheny will host and perform. I spoke with Jim Hall when his most recent album, All Across the City, was released, but we began with a duet from a different album. This is Alone Together with bassist Ron Carter. Jim Hall told me about his first guitar. He was 10 years old. It was a Christmas present.
Yeah, my mom bought that for me in Cleveland, Ohio, and we sort of paid it off a dollar and a quarter or something a week to this music store in Cleveland, and I took lessons. I think the lessons were 75 cents, and the rest went toward the guitar. So it took about a year to actually pay it off.
Had you hinted for the guitar? Did you know you wanted one?
I had... This Uncle Ed, who was sort of like Willie Nelson in Ohio, he wasn't that famous, but he played the guitar and he sang country songs, and he always had nice-looking ladies around him, so I thought that looks like a good way to go.
So many musicians seem to have chosen their instrument or decided to play music because it would help you
nice
make it with
ladies.
The ladies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He also drank a lot, and I decided not to go that way.
Mm-hmm. So. Did you have any idea what you wanted to play?
I don't believe I did until I heard Charlie Christian, which was about 3 years later. I heard him on Benny Goodman Records, and then I knew that whatever he was doing was what I wanted to do. I didn't really know. It just seemed like a nice idea to hold a guitar and play it. So,
is it fair to say that Charlie Christian has remained your primary influence over the years?
I think so, yeah. I hadn't really thought about it quite that way, but when I hear him now, on those records that I heard when I was 13, he sounds better than he did when I was 13. And I would still, I think if I could play one solo that sounds to me as complete and perfect as the way Charlie played, I would feel great. So, yes, I think he's still the Holy Grail or something that I'm looking for.
What were the early bands like that you played in?
Terrible. I played polkas and mazurkas and all kinds of stuff and didn't really know any better, and I think it was good that I didn't, because I got all that groundwork out of the way before my judgment had formed. We had in junior high school, there was a quartet, which was accordion, clarinet, drums, and guitar. So you can almost hear it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the good thing about that was that the clarinet player...
A strange grouping of instruments.
Kind of standard, and yeah. No, nobody owned a bass.
Uh-huh.
Accordion was very big in Ohio. And we played all kinds of stuff, probably very badly. But the clarinet player loved Benny Goodman, and so it was through him that I heard Charlie Christian. And then shortly after that, I started playing in better groups. I got socially and musically involved with older guys, like in their 20s, who got me listening to Lester Young and Coleman Hawkins and Ben Webster and Art Tatum. Art Tatum was a big influence, musical influence. So by the time I was, say, 15 or 16, I was pretty well gone down the jazz road there.
Well, in one interview, you said that you felt you were leading a double life when you were in high school, because on the one hand, you were the president of your class and making speeches about citizenship.
Right.
But on the other hand, you were spending your evenings playing in a saloon.
In saloons, right.
Yeah, with guys much older than you were. Well, did you feel any guilt about spending your nights playing in saloons?
yes, I did. But I'm still getting over it. 100 years of analysis later. Oh, sure, the Midwestern kind of... religious upbringing and the conflict that involved. It was probably one of the reasons I stayed in music was because it was considered slightly sinful to be playing jazz in a saloon. So, yeah, there was some kind of conflict, but I loved it at that time, and I'm still trying to straighten it out.
Were you from a religious upbringing?
Kind of. Baptist, Protestant Baptist, and I don't want to get into the whole thing, but some parts of the family were a little even more extreme than the Baptists, and there was a lot of dichotomy there between the music that I loved and the way of life that was supposed to be correct.
So did you get any pressure?
Is that carefully enough?
Yeah, right. Well, did you get pressure from your family to get out of that life?
Yeah, occasionally I did, but then... gradually, I went straight for 5 years. I went to an actual music school, a conservatory, and that seemed to satisfy some of that straight and narrow stuff. Also turned me into a much better musician. It was one of the best things I've ever done. So after I graduated from high school, I went through the Cleveland Institute of Music for about 5 years. And that was terrific. And then I continued my life of sin right after that, up to the present.
Well, you actually dropped out before getting your master's degree.
I did, yeah.
And decided to go to the West Coast. Mm-hmm. Was that a big risk for you, and were you a risk taker?
I think what happened was that I finally panicked at the idea of being in school forever. I'd been there for 5 years, and a lot of the people that I knew were going to school in order to stay on in school and teach. And I think somewhere in the back of my mind, I'd always wondered if I could be a professional guitar player, because I was doing that all the time anyway, weekends and during the summer. So, in a sense, it was a risk, in that the only thing I had in Los Angeles was I had this aunt who said I could sleep on her couch if I came out there, and I had one friend with whom I'd studied arranging, who was pretty successful in Los Angeles. So... In that sense, it was a risk, but another sense, it felt great. A friend of mine and me drove a car out. You could deliver cars then and just pay the gas money. So we drove this lavender Cadillac to Los Angeles, and I started practicing as soon as we took off from Cleveland. I sat in the back seat and practiced for about the next 2 years. So it was a lot of fun, actually, more than a chance.
Guitarist Jim Hall is my guest, and let me play the first album that you recorded under your own name, mm-hmm. you know, with your group, and mm-hmm. then we'll talk about the events leading okay. up to it. And this is from an album that was first released in 1957 that's since been reissued on compact disc. The album's called Jazz Guitar, and Jim Hall's trio in this features Carl Perkins at the piano and Red Mitchell on bass. Let's hear Tangerine. Guitarist Jim Hall from his first album called Jazz Guitar. How old were you when you made that record?
Let's see, 26, I guess. 25, 26, 26, I think.
What were you working on?
I thought you were going to say, what was I
time?
Wearing?
No.
Was I working?
No, and you're playing. You know, what were you really concerned with
I was
that
just
time?
Thinking about that as the record was playing. I think I probably loved Zoot Sims and Lester Young about then, and I can kind of hear that in my playing. I was around Zoot Sims a lot for a period of years, and I loved his rhythmic sense, his sense of time, and I loved Lester's melodic sense. So it sounds like kind of a combination of the two of them and a little bit of Charlie Christian. The notes were a little shorter than the way I play now. Sounded pretty good. I tend more toward ballads, and I'm really not sure what, it's just a matter, I hope, of some kind of growth, and I think my hearing has changed over the years.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
And my guest is one of today's top jazz guitarists, Jim Hall, and he has a new album that's just been released on Concord Records, and it's called All Across the City. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Guitarist Jim Hall is my guest. Over the years, you've played with many different musicians, including Jimmy Giuffre, who you mentioned, Ben mm-hmm. Webster, Sonny Rollins, Lee Konitz, Bill Evans. Some of the musicians you've played with have been black. Some of them have been white. You've played in groups of, I think, all different racial configurations. Mm-hmm. And there's been times when the group has been predominantly white with a black musician, and there's times where the group's been predominantly black and you've been the white musician. Mm-hmm. What are some of the absurdities you've run into in various configurations with how, like, the black player or the white player was treated?
Well, often when I was working with Sonny Rollins, I was, hate to even get into racial things, but nevertheless, it's a fact that I was the white guy in the group, and often we'd be checking into a hotel, and the people at the hotel would assume I was the manager, whereas in reality, I was the most unmanageable one in the group. And then I remember driving cross-country with Chico Hamilton, and this was in the 50s, and Chico wouldn't even get out of the car going through the South and the West, and I'd have to go in for... for food and bring it out to him. And he was the leader of the group. That was, I would say, absurd in every sense of the word. Mostly the experiences were terrific. I wouldn't trade any of that. The peripheral business reflected the what was happening in the country and still is, I think.
After playing for years and, after being on the road for years in the mid-1960s, you decided to come off the mm-hmm. road for a while, and you got a job in New York working in the band of the Merv Griffin Show.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to go off the road?
I felt I'd had enough of it for a while. I was interested in getting married, and I'm not quite sure. I think I was tired. I'd been on the road almost constantly for about 10 years. And the Griffin Show job was available, so I took it.
What kinds of music were you called on to play?
Garbage. the same people. I felt like I was, what did Yogi Berra say? Deja vu all over again. I had played for these nuts when I was a kid. You'd play a wedding and the bride would have a cousin or something, and he'd come up and sing, and it was always bad, and they'd get lost. So now these guys are stars, and you're... So I did this when I was 14. That's the way it felt to me. And then occasionally... Well, I got to play with Count Basie on that show. We had a big band for a while when I went to CBS, and I had never played with Basie, and I also got to play with Duke Ellington. You know, by default, we were there. We were the band. But generally, we would play while the world was watching TV commercials. We'd be playing some of our stuff. And it was a good band. Musically, it was terrific. Bob Brookmeyer was in the band. Richie Kamuka, marvelous tenor player. Jake Hanna was the drummer. For a while, we had Kai Winding. Benny Powell was another trombone player. Great, great musicians. But I don't even particularly want to dwell on it. It was just a bad, not something that I would, it's not what I started out to do, and I managed to get out of it.
Hmm. Well, I want to play something that you recorded in the mid-1970s. This is from an album called Concerto. And I'm going to play the alternate take of your recording of The Answer Is Yes, which is a song that was written by your wife, Jane mm-hmm. Hall. And playing the alternate take here because it features a lot more of you.
And yeah.
It's issued on the CD version of the album. You want to say anything about this before we hear it?
Yeah, I'm nervous. I never heard this.
You didn't? Take.
Oh. It's a tough tune. My wife did write it, and I say that because it has the bridge on it is difficult. And I remember that Chet Baker had a tough time getting through the bridge. Because he didn't read chord changes. He played entirely by ear. He's a marvelous player. I'm curious to hear it.
Well, let's give it a listen.
Yeah. Thank you.
An excerpt of The Answer Is Yes, featuring my guest, guitarist Jim Hall, from his reissued album, Concierto. Well, I liked it. What'd you think?
It was kind of interesting. Roland Hanna wasn't even on that take, it sounds like, and neither was Chet. So maybe that's why we did another one. I guess that was just a trio version. I think I have a CD of that, but I haven't heard it yet. I sort of liked the way I was thrashing through the chord changes there. Worked out all right.
You've never been one of these, like, flashy speed guitarists.
No. I never could. Actually, I often wish that I could do that and then just not, because I chose not to. But the guitar's been difficult for me to play physically. It gets better occasionally. Like, for instance, I was talking with Don Lukoff on the way up here. I had to play solos in Brazil a couple of years ago, and that really frightened me. So I practiced every morning. I'd wake up in a sweat about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'd practice till about 9, then go back to sleep. And I actually did get better. My technique got better. I got faster. I also got through the solo concerts. But I've never really had that particular kind of speed facility. I think I have other kinds of techniques that I use on the guitar, but speed has never been one of them. So that's why I play slower tempos and ballads.
Certain people have this almost stereotyped view of the jazz musician as hipster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's an image that physically you don't fit into. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? The hipster image. Did people ever say to you, you don't look like a jazz musician?
Mm-hmm. Yes, or a number of other things, too. Yeah, sure. That's why I said people thought I was the band manager on the road.
Well, right. So how do you react to that?
I enjoy that. I get a kick out of it. If you can play, then it makes it even more fun. You don't look like an athlete, but actually you're Babe Ruth or something. That's pretty good.
Jazz guitarist Jim Hall. He'll perform at the JVC Jazz Festival in New York this Tuesday. He'll play with many of the people he's played with over the years. The duets, trios, and ensembles will feature musicians such as Jerry Mulligan, Gary Burton, and Ron Carter. And the evening will be hosted by Pat Metheny. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the life of Irving Berlin with his biographer, Lawrence Berggreen. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. He played Baby John in the stage and screen versions of West Side Story, but Elliot Feld is better known as the founder of a ballet company that integrates classical and modern dance. Coming up, we meet the founder of the Elliot Feld Ballet. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead introduces us to some English jazz inspired by musicians like John Coltrane and Sonny Rollins. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the new season of POV, Public Television Series of Documentaries. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. An explosion occurred this evening at an exclusive club in London, reportedly injuring 4 people seriously. Vera Frankel in London has more on the story.
Any bomber could be confident that the Carlton Club would be full of prominent people. It's a favorite haunt of leading conservatives and has Prime Minister Thatcher as a member. Tonight's bomb rocked the building and brought part of it tumbling down. 24 people were rescued from the wreckage, but it seems that not everyone who is at the club tonight has been accounted for. The head of Scotland Yard's anti-terrorist squad says the blast was caused by 10 to 15 pounds of high explosive planted near the entrance. The surrounding area, the heart of London's clubland, has been evacuated. And latest reports say fire crews inspecting the scene of the explosion have pulled back because of fears that there may be a second bomb. So far, no one's claimed responsibility for the attack. For National Public Radio, this is Vera Frankel in London.
In the wake of last week's massive earthquake, aid to Iran is arriving from dozens of other countries. It's estimated 500,000 people are homeless after the quake, and thousands are believed still buried in the rubble. The quake, which levels cities and towns across northern Iran, has killed an estimated 50,000 people. About 200,000 others were injured. Leading Chinese dissident Feng Lijue and his wife have left China for Great Britain after a year in the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. They had been there since the crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators in 1989. NPR's Ted Clark has more on the story.
Feng had to sign a statement before authorities would let him leave China. Beijing says the statement showed signs of repentance on Feng's part for his role in the pro-democracy movement. But in fact, the statement merely reiterates Feng's opposition to cardinal principles of the Chinese Constitution, such as the primacy of the Communist Party. The statement also contains a vaguely worded pledge not to participate in activities, quote, whose motive lies in opposing China. The statement also says Feng will seek medical treatment abroad. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler welcomed Feng's release.
This humanitarian action is a far-sighted, significant step that will improve the atmosphere for progress in our bilateral relations.
But for now, U.S. economic sanctions against China remain in place. Administration officials say they continue to be troubled by ongoing human rights abuses in China. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
South Africa's central bank says that it's been intervening to prop up the price of gold because of a slump in gold prices. Early this month, gold dropped to a four-year low. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 12 points to close at 2,845.05 on volume of some 133 million shares. Trading was light as declining issues led advances. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. There's a new British invasion going on in music, an invasion of English jazz musicians. Jazz has been part of the English music scene through the century, with musicians playing in the full range of styles, from Dixieland to big band swing to free jazz. But before now, few of their records made their way to the U.S. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has this review of a few records by young English improvisers. This is singer Cleveland Watkiss.
For all we know, this may only be a dream that comes and goes like a ripple on a stream. So love me tonight. Tomorrow was made for some. Tomorrow may never come. For all we know, tomorrow may never come. For all we know.
Cleveland Watkiss reminds some people of Bobby McFerrin. But on ballads, he sounds more like he's trying to be the new Steve Lawrence. He has a problem shared by other young British jazz musicians. Their stuff sometimes sounds a little contrived and secondhand. It's not like all English improvisers have that problem. Some, who came up in the 60s, developed highly personal sounds, like soprano saxophonist Evan Parker, who sounds like he's playing his brainwave patterns. The new British players with records out in the States are a lot closer to the mainstream. The heavy hitters are saxophone players. The best known is 25-year-old Courtney Pine, whose third album, The Vision's Tale, is on the Antilles label. It was recorded in New York with an American rhythm section. Pine is a big admirer of John Coltrane, but on some of his new album, he doesn't evoke the master, he impersonates him. On Coltrane's test piece, Giant Steps, he takes liberties with the melody, but his solo mostly rehashes hot Coltrane licks. It's flashy, but why listen to fake Coltrane when you can put on a record by the real one? Whitney Pine was born in London to Jamaican parents and has spoken of trying to incorporate his Caribbean background into his music. So far, he hasn't made much progress. In fact, from album to album, his playing keeps getting less distinctive. Saxophonist Steve Williamson is also 25, and also from London's West Indian community. Most of his debut album for the Verve label, called A Waltz for Grace, was also recorded in America with American musicians. And Williamson, too, has an American role model. Much of the time, his slithery approach recalls Brooklyn alto player Steve Coleman, who helped produce the record. Like Coleman, Williamson has a fresh approach to playing chord changes, but can sound a little clinical. He's not as hot a player as Courtney Pine. Steve Williamson's strong point is his catchy writing, which does hint at his Caribbean roots. Favorite recent release by a younger English sax man was also recorded in New York by a 26-year-old straight-ahead tenor player who really burns. But there's a catch. He made it in 1961 and died of heart failure in the early 70s. His name is Tubby Hayes. His album, The New York Sessions, is on Columbia Records. Goes on like that for another couple of minutes. Tubby Hayes plays two Sonny Rollins tunes on his album, and obviously appreciated Rollins a lot. But that didn't stop him from coming up with a sound of his own. He was really an inspired soloist. It's true that young players like Courtney Pine and Steve Williamson are helping to revive the English jazz scene. But this Tubby Hayes album reminds us that English jazz already had a long and healthy past.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. This is Fresh Air. Feld Ballet mixes the elegance of classical dance and the freedom of modern dance. The company was founded in 1974 by Elliot Feld. Since 1978, he's also run a dance school that recruits from New York's public schools. There's no tuition, and the city provides bus transportation. Two former students are now members of the Feld Ballet. Elliot Feld formerly danced with the American Ballet Theater and performed on Broadway. He's choreographed about 60 dances. I asked him about the difficulties of integrating ballet and modern dance.
Well, I think that the classical tradition is one of lightness and the disguise of effort, so it should never appear difficult. And modern dance comes from a tradition of the earth, that things are down into the ground, and it tends to be more expressive of emotions that are familiar to us. It doesn't deal very often with princes and with fairy tales. So the notion of making ballet, or the feeling to make ballet somehow more expressive or more a part of our lives as we understand them and as dancing is today, I think is a kind of an attempt to reconcile that feeling of lightness with ground.
When did you first start studying dance?
I started at 11 years old at Balanchine School, the School of American Ballet.
Was this because you wanted to, or because a parent suggested that it would be good for you?
No. I don't know why I wanted to dance. I had probably only seen Bambi Lynn on the Ed Sullivan Show. I'm serious. And I just always did, and I don't know why.
Were you ever afraid of the sissy connection that, you know, friends would think, oh, you know, he's queer, he dances ballet?
No, I wasn't afraid of that because I just didn't let them know. Because
you
clearly,
didn't let them know you danced?
Yeah. I used to go at age 11 from Brooklyn to Madison Avenue, where Mr. Balanchine had the school. And I used to carry my dance clothes in this little black attaché case as though I was on my way to Wall Street or something. You know, it's the child broker. But then I went to the High School of Performing Arts, and I mean, it was not a big deal.
Well, everyone's into the arts there. Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think it had to do with dancing. I mean, as you're, you know, finding your own sexual identity, that's a very scary time anyway. I don't think it was made more fearful because of dancing.
Were there any advantages being one of the few boys who, you know, who was dancing of your age?
There were great advantages. I started dancing in 1954, and I was one of two boys at the School of American Ballet, one of two in the entire school. And so 3 months after I began, I was the little prince in the first production of The Nutcracker. Well, you know, I went from a kid from Brooklyn to being a prince in a classical ballet in 3 months. So I certainly know the rewards of there being very few male dancers. And now the competition is much greater. And I'm grateful, because I did not have a great facility for ballet dancing, that the competition was not as keen when I was coming up.
I think it was when you were 16, you joined the cast of West Side Story, and you were in the Broadway version, first, I think, as one of the Sharks, and then as Baby John?
Yes.
And then you were in the movie as Baby John, too.
Correct.
How did you get the part at age 16?
I was actually walking on Broadway with a girl I was going with, and she said, "I dare you to go backstage and sign up for West Side Story to audition." So I went backstage, you know, on a dare, you'll do anything. And then I got a call to come to an audition. There were hundreds of people. And through a series of auditions, I was selected. And there was great cachet to being in the show. I mean, in 1958, it was the show. And you got to grow your hair long, and everybody knew you were in it. It was wonderful.
How did you feel being this gang member, breaking out into dance? You know?
Well, I
love the show, but there's always something like slightly incongruous about it, you know, because you always expect, well, gee, gangs, it should be like a rock and roll soundtrack or something. I mean, this was
before rock and roll. This is when 58. Rock and roll was Dion and the Belmonts. I mean, that was
nothing
rock and
wrong
roll.
With that.
No. But I mean, it's not rock and roll like today. But it's interesting in the show. I think because theater tells you to suspend certain realistic expectations, that once you enter that world, you forgive its conceits, and you actually embrace those conceits. So I don't think in the show it bothered me, but whenever I would see the movie, I always thought, why are these guys dancing? I mean, because the buildings were real, the cement was real,
yeah.
Everything was real, and somehow I couldn't make, why are these fellas dancing? I don't understand it. So I know the feeling that you're talking about, but on the stage I found it credible.
I think after West Side Story, you did a couple of other shows. I think you danced in Fiddler on the Roof,
right.
And I Can Get It for You Wholesale.
Right.
Did you like being in those kinds of Broadway shows? They were...
Well, mostly I did it for money,
yeah, sure.
Quite frankly. I was in American Ballet Theater when I did Fiddler, and we were on, you know, a six-month layoff, and
uh-huh.
I called Jerry and I said, you know, is there any work anywhere? I mean, I needed to pay my rent. And he said, yeah, go see Tommy back at Fiddler. I think that we can find something. And in 3 days after that, I was in charge of the show because Tommy had to go to Israel to set the production in Israel.
Huh. You danced on some of the TV variety shows, right?
Right.
Gary Moore,
mm-hmm.
Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
Let me guess, were these production numbers where there was maybe a slightly washed up female singer.
Well,
doing
actually,
a
not necessarily. I mean, I danced with Liza Minnelli.
Oh, really?
I mean, I didn't dance with her. I was one of the backup fellas. So it wasn't always washed up people. She wasn't washed up. I think she was about 18 at the time.
Right. Did you enjoy the choreography? My personal memories are of some very kind of corny choreography that came out of
those variety shows. Oh, it was crap. I mean, what are we talking about? It was awful. I mean, it was just terrible. But I was young and ignorant, and it was great, so.
Okay. You founded your company in 1975.
Four.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Why did you want your own company?
I didn't like working for other people, Terry. It's really a question of trying to find the freedom to do what you feel the calling to do. And in the context of a large institution, which ballet companies are, they're large institutions, your needs are secondary to the institutional needs. And so I decided that for me, the best thing was to have a company of my own, if I could manage to. And although one gives up many the prerogatives and, to be much easier to let somebody else pay the dancers and to let somebody else rent the theater and to do all of that, I found it that it served my professional and aesthetic ambitions to take on those burdens because it gave me a kind of freedom I couldn't have otherwise.
Do you have to keep up to a schedule of new dances for each season? In other words, do you feel like you have to work almost on a quota of coming up with a certain number of new dances every year?
Well, I do, but more from an internal, more for myself than for the company.
Oh, so that you feel that you're keeping fresh and
so
producing.
That I know that I'm alive.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when I finish a ballet, the great fear is that, will I ever have the feeling to do another ballet?
Yeah.
There is a day when I finish it and I look and I say, ah, yes, I did it. And then the next day it's like, okay, so what are you going to do now? But sometimes it does feel a little bit like the tail is wagging the dog. I mean, when you really get exhausted and you're replacing dancers because dancers come and go. Like anything, there's the despair of the fact that you never arrive. There is no such thing as getting there. It's all just trying. It's all effort. It's always beginning again. It's always beginning again. That's what's exhausting about it, and that's what's thrilling about it.
It must be really frustrating when a dancer who you really like leaves, either because they're retiring or they're forming a new company or they're going to another company.
It's only a small death. Yes. No, it is. I mean, the dancers that you... That become your means of expression, with whom you have shared the most intimate. It's not that it's intimate in a social way necessarily, but in a professional way, which is often much deeper. That these what you felt were commitments turn out to simply have been temporary, and it's you really have to harden yourself to it because there were times when I just thought, I just can't go on. I mean, I have to quit. And then you start again. And that's what I'm saying, that it's always starting again.
I guess that's another reason, too, why it's nice to know that there's a school that you're running with a lot of new people coming up through the ranks.
That's exactly right. That is why. Because it gives you the end, the beginning of the continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there for you to see so that when your end, which is the far side, may be in disarray, you can look back at the beginning and say, ah, but yes, in only 8 years, that child will be a wonderful dancer.
Choreographer Elliot Feld, he recently changed the name of his company to Feld Ballets New York. The company will perform a preview week August 20th through 25th at the Joyce Theater in New York. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up at All Things Considered. Noah Adams has the answer. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. The dissidents Fong Li Xue and Li Shuxian, his wife, have left China for England after more than a year in the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. They had been granted political asylum there, and they're now on their way to Cambridge University in England. I'll talk with one of their sons, a student in Detroit. Nelson Mandela talks with President Bush at the White House, and they differ on the issue of whether the African National Congress should renounce violence in its effort to end apartheid in South Africa. A further split in Poland between Lech Wałęsa and the Solidarity Movement. Also, NPR's Patricia Neiman has a follow-up report on the treatment process for a young crack cocaine addict.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. POV is an abbreviation for the filmmaker's term, point of view. The documentary series called POV begins its third season on public television this week with Nina Rosenblum's film about three female prisoners and the conditions in the prison where they're incarcerated. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
It wasn't that many years ago that summer was as dull on PBS as it was on the commercial networks. Then Public TV launched a summer series called Alive from Off Center, and the experiment worked so well that other series followed. So now, while the other networks are showing reruns and rejected pilots, PBS is showing some of its strongest stuff. Alive from Off Center and American Masters begin new seasons next week, and POV starts its third season this week. The leadoff show is called Through the Wire, and it's about women prisoners at a control unit facility in Lexington, Kentucky. The conditions there sound pretty brutal, especially when filmmaker Rosenblum lets the prisoners themselves describe them.
My name is Susan Rosenberg. I'm a political prisoner. The high security unit is living death. There's no human interaction. There's no contact with anybody who is not affiliated with the Bureau of Prisons. And I believe that this is an experiment being conducted by the Justice Department to try and destroy political prisoners.
Through the Wire lets the evidence of inhumane treatment pile up. There's a 1988 clip from the Today Show criticizing the prison facility, and an interview with an ACLU psychologist who evaluated the prison and its effect on the three women. The warden, in his interview, comes off like one of those by-the-book tough guys in a women in prison movie. And Rosenblum stacks the deck by showing home movies of the three women prisoners as kids and interviewing their parents. In this scene, Susan Rosenberg's father tries to read a birthday poem she wrote for him from prison.
There is no peace without justice. There is no justice without freedom.
I want to read it, man.
It's all right. No, that's all right. There's no freedom without dignity, liberation.
All right.
Well, anyway, the ending is that, Father dear, be well, be strong. And I can answer this, the tears are just part of this thing, but, and know that the struggle continues and all that life is hope. Love, Venceremos, Susan.
Naturally, this kind of documentary is subjective and manipulative. But that's the point of POV. You could say the same thing about The Thin Blue Line and Roger and Me and even Edward R. Murrow's Harvest of Shame. These days, most network documentaries, even PBS ones, are so timid that they're afraid to tilt the balance or draw a conclusion. Not POV, and that's what makes this summer series such a hot ticket.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, Joyce Lieberman, and Ojiva Blidis. Chris Burgin directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Irving Berlin's biographer, Lawrence Berggren. And we talk with David Wojnarowicz, an artist at the center of the debate about government funding of controversial art. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.